This podcast is sponsored by Westbur Tree Equipment. That's Westbur that are based in the US. So just actually over the border from me here in Canada. Their base is only about 45 minutes away from here. So I get the benefit of being able to actually go into the store when I'm down in the States. So Westbur, they pride themselves on, you know, having a huge range of products to offer to you guys out there, but they really like to give you that small town kind of friendly feeling when you call up or when you go into the store. You know, they're all about customer service, and I can really vouch for that. If ever you call up with any questions, especially like any technical questions about rope or harnesses or gear, if you get a chance to speak to nice guy Dave about equipment, then you know you'll be absolutely blown away on the knowledge that guy has, especially about when it comes to like rope construction, splicing, any of that stuff. He is just a wealth of knowledge. So anything that nice guy Dave doesn't know is not worth knowing about rope. So they're really trying to give you like the best customer service, and they really do. They really look after their customers. So if you go on to westbur.com/pod, so use the URL westbur.com/pod, and you know, do your shopping, see what takes your fancy, order yourself some nice little shiny toys. You know, we all love that shiny equipment. And then when you get to the checkout, enter the promo code POD, that's pod, POD, and you'll save yourself 10%. So westbur.com/pod, and enter the promo code POD at checkout, and you will save yourself 10% off your first order. So that is how nice Westbur are to you guys, the listeners of this very podcast. Today I've got a real treat of a podcast for you. My guest today is a guy called David Anderson, who is a biologist. He does a lot of research on birds, and he's also a tree climber. Taught himself tree climbing a long, long time ago. He has some fantastic stories. He also runs the non-profit Canopy Watch, so you may follow him on social media, but if you don't, go to Canopy Watch on Instagram. He's got a fantastic Instagram, and you can follow along with the projects that he works on. He's got a project coming up down in Colombia where he's taking I think it was about 22 biologists and teaching them how to climb trees, how to get into the canopy, and we go into all of that in detail. We talk about some of his adventures down in South America where he's taken other researchers, and he's also been in the trees and what he's experienced. Absolutely unbelievable stories that he has. So I was able to do this podcast in person, so I got a real good insight into his background and into what he does, and just the stories that he has. So I hope you enjoyed the podcast. This is a fantastic one. Thank you very much to David Anderson again, and hope you all enjoy it.
When they're not climbing trees, they're making videos about trees. When they're not making videos about trees, they're competing in trees. When they're not doing that, they're fiddling with hardware. And when they're not fiddling with their hardware, they're milling wood. And when they're not milling wood, they're pulling wood out of their pants. By wood, I mean sawdust. And when they're not doing any of that, well, they're talking trees.
All right, David, thanks very much for joining me. This is awesome to have you on the podcast. Obviously, you don't live anywhere near I do, so it's nice that we both are coming to the same event in the same place, that we could kind of do this in person.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me. People look up to you a lot, and I'm really happy to have a chance to talk about some of the things that I do and maybe teach a few things and just have a good conversation about climbing. It's one of my favorite topics.
Awesome. Yeah, this will be something a little bit different from me talking to most of the tree climbers that I know and I'm involved with, because they're in the same industry and they do the exact same occupation that I do, whereas it's a little different with you because you're a biologist, but that's also tied to tree climbing and that kind of thing. And I don't know, I know a little bit about what you do, but I don't know where it all started and how you got into the tree climbing aspect and then how that has taken off to what you're doing today. So if you could kind of just explain how you got into being a biologist and like where that came from, and then how far down into your career did you, when did you first climb a tree, and then obviously that must have, you know, been a good experience to do what you're doing today. So
yeah, I'm an ornithologist, right? I specialize in birds, and birds, you know, I'm a human being. I walk around on the ground, but birds live all over at different elevations in the forest. And I wanted to be able to study birds where they live, not necessarily where I stand.
Yeah.
So I wanted to learn how to climb trees. I got the idea. I wanted to do a master's degree in the rainforest in Central America, and I wanted to study birds of prey in the top of the forest.
Wow.
And really, I kind of hatched a plan. Like, I knew that I wanted to live in this little Indian village in a place called the Rio Platino Biosphere Reserve. And I knew I wanted to climb trees. And so I kind of made up like a master's degree research program that could enable me to do that. And
when you say you made up a master's degree,
yeah, you know, like the ends justifies the means. This is kind of a case where the means justifies the ends. You know, I wanted to climb trees. I wanted to live in this forest. I had visited one time. It was like this Amazonia in Central America, this big, wide open rainforest with this one Indian village that you can only get to in dugout canoes or by walking. And so I said, well, how am I going to be able to live in this place for a year? And how am I going to be able to climb trees? I don't have any equipment. Well, I'll go to school. I'll go to graduate school. So I wrote a proposal for a study that I could do that had all of these ingredients. This place, this village, climbing trees, and birds. And so I made this up, and then I started writing grant proposals to pay for the whole thing. And then I got a master's degree out of it.
So had you been to the village before?
One time.
Okay, and had you climbed trees before?
No, I had never climbed trees before in my life. And so really the odds were kind of stacked against me because I'd never climbed trees before. I'd only been in this village for a couple of days and it blew me away and it impressed me by how beautiful and how wild it was. And I wrote a proposal, a research proposal that I would send to professors all over the United States, any professor I could find that was studying birds outside the United States. I sent them this proposal. And I just kept getting rejection after rejection after rejection. And finally, this one professor called me and said, I'll take you and we'll do it. And we did it, but I had to fund the whole thing. Like, I had to write all of the grants to pay for the whole thing. But the funny thing about it is, and this is what I tell, like when I teach tree climbing nowadays, the funny thing about it was I knew nothing about tree climbing. So I talked with a couple of scientists who had climbed trees, and they gave me some training. And the training consisted of like three trips to climb cottonwoods along the Boise River in Boise, Idaho, where we lived, with spurs. And then I would rappel out on a figure eight. And I did that like three times with them and maybe once or twice by myself, and then I went to the rainforest. And I was like, I was so far over my head. It was totally ridiculous.
So at that point, you'd done these three tree climbs using spurs.
Yeah.
And so you obviously weren't familiar with any of the modern day arboricultural tree climbing practice.
This was in 1996.
Okay.
And I don't know how modern arboricultural climbing was in 96, but yeah. Truthfully, all I had was... I had a big tree climbing saddle with D-rings. Yeah. I had a flip line that was made out of hemp. It was braided hemp with a wire cable in the middle. And then I wore a rock, because I thought I was going to be doing technical stuff. Underneath that, I wore a rock climbing harness. And then I had a sling over my shoulder And attached to that, like a webbing sling, I had a bunch of other webbing slings and a bunch of carabiners. And I was climbing trees with that. And I was climbing trees like 130 to 150 feet with like no previous experience at that height. It was totally insane. Like, I don't recommend that to anyone.
So what were you doing with the webbing slings? Was that more?
So I'd tie myself into the tree with that.
Okay, that was kind of like rock climbing style? Or just clipping directly to the webbing sling?
I would put a girth hitch around a branch and connect to my rock climbing harness.
Okay.
And then I did have one piece of really high-tech equipment. You're going to love this. I took a really, really long piece of one-inch webbing, like 60 feet long, and I tied overhand knots in it approximately every 10 inches and made like this long daisy chain. And then I had this thing that I could clip in. It was adjustable length. So I could clip into any two rings, whether it was like, you know, 12 feet around a branch and back down to me, or just like right in front of me. Yeah. And that was my safety. That was the thing that kept me from falling out of trees.
Nice.
That was my high-tech piece of equipment. That was quite progressive.
That
was quite progressive. Yeah.
Definitely. That was your own idea?
Someone else, one of the guys who taught me climbing in Boise kind of mentioned that. And so we manufactured one. Yeah.
So you did your degree.
Yeah.
And then while you were doing your degree, you were learning to tree climb, or did the tree climbing get put aside while you did?
So here's the funny thing. I thought that at that time I was a really advanced tree climber. I mean, I was climbing trees, so therefore that made me a tree climber. And I was climbing 2 to 3 trees a day, and these trees are like 130 to 150 feet tall, and I was spurring up these trees. And I don't use spurs anymore, and I haven't spurred a lot of trees in the United States, so I don't really have anything to compare. But some of the tropical trees have extremely dense wood, and those spurs like don't even enter. They're like skating on the top of the wood, and the wood is, the bark is smooth like a tabletop, and it was honestly really scary. So what I tell people is that when I thought that I was a good tree climber, I had no idea how much I didn't know about tree climbing, honestly. And I made a lot of mistakes, and fortunately I never paid really heavily for those mistakes, but I made a lot of mistakes. And the one thing that really kept me alive, really, that really kept my research going and stuff, is I had a really small toolkit. Meaning I didn't try and do a lot of skills. I tried to do a few things, and I tried to do them really well, and I just didn't try and do anything extra. And so I got really good at a small set of skills. And then I kind of took that to mean that I was a good tree climber. And then the funny thing is, so I finished my degree in 1998, and I took time off. You know, I had, you know, some jobs and stuff, and I really wanted to get back into the trees, and I really wanted to get back into the tropical rainforest, so I did the whole thing over again. I went to get a PhD, and I made up some more research to get me back into the trees that had to do with climbing and birds. And then I got accepted into university, and like I repeated the whole thing.
So you're like an expert at writing grants and these
writing kinds. Grants is important, yeah, because I had to pay for it all, and you know, yeah. So that's one of the important skills that's helped me a lot, both like in get a degree, but you know, we can talk about this after, like today, nowadays, when I want to do climber trainings in Latin America, I have to pay for that through grant writing. Mm. But what I really want to say that's important is that for my master's degree, it was 1996, and I subsequently learned how to install a line in a tree so I didn't have to spur. And then I would climb up on Jumars, literally with Jumar brand handheld ascenders with a Texas system, and go up the tree and come back down. 10 years later, 2006, I'm getting my doctorate degree, and I'm using the exact same technique. Install a line in a tree, rock climbing harness, Jumars to the top and back down. So in 10 years, I didn't progress at all. And yet I still thought I was like some sort of advanced
But at that time, from what was it, 96 to 2006, you say, I don't know how much more you could have progressed in the terms of like accessing the tree. That was, I mean, even in 2006, that was probably seen as quite advanced for tree climbing to be accessing using cams and that kind of thing. So, I mean, you got in there early with that system.
You know, Jepsen wrote the Tree Climber's Companion. Do you know what year was that? Was that 99 or 2002?
I'm not sure on the year.
Somewhere in between, though. Somewhere in between my 2 degrees. And I actually bought the book before I went down to Central America the second time, but I couldn't figure out the methods on my own. And so even though tree climbing in general, like for arborists, was progressing and there was new methods and new equipment like throw bags and throw lines and stuff like that, I was immune to that for a long time.
So how were you getting your line installed then?
That's a good question.
The smirk on your face.
You know, that's almost top secret. I use a crossbow to install lines in tall trees.
Oh, okay.
And so, like I say, I got really good at a small skill set. Like in a tropical rainforest, the forest is so dense and the vegetation is so thick that it's hard to see your target. You have to know where to stand. And then the crossbow is really too powerful for short trees, and you have to know like how to break the line. When I say break, I mean like break your car, like stop it. You know, so that it doesn't go.
Slow it down.
You have to slow it down so that it doesn't go over the tree and then the next tree and the next tree after that, and then you're like pulling your weight, you know, through all these trees. So I got pretty good at setting lines in trees, and then I got really good like I could get up a rope pretty fast.
So it sounds
that's all I knew.
Yeah, but so it sounds like you were saying you learn a few skills, but you learn them very well. So. Yeah. To a lot of arborists, they would see you doing that and they would be like, this is awesome. We wouldn't be able to get into the canopy of like large trees, whereas you became like an expert at that. But then you were saying you didn't even know the throw ball and the throw weight. And so for you to see a tree climber using the throw ball and being accurate, you'd be like, I don't know anything.
So I'll tell you what happened. One day a light bulb came on. I was in the top of a tree. And the next tree over from me, there was a bird that was flying in with spiders in its bill over and over and over. And I knew that that the bird had a nest there, okay? And I was thinking, you know, my method always kept me close to the trunk of the tree. And then I would get to the top of the tree and I would tie into a branch with a girth hitch and a webbing sling, and I would sit there and watch birds and do my study. And I saw that bird in the next tree over, and I knew that it had a nest, and I also knew that the nest of this bird had never been described by a scientist. No one had ever actually seen it and reported what it looked like. And I wanted to get to that next tree. But from the ground, you couldn't see the top of that tree, and I couldn't install a line in the tree. And I didn't know, and it wasn't that far. It was like 15 or 20 feet. It wasn't really that far. And so I started thinking at that day, like, if I could only get to the next tree, if I could only get to the next tree. And so it started me thinking like, there's gotta be more to tree climbing than going up a rope and coming back down a rope. When I was doing this research, I was a student at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, and I lived there when Hurricane Katrina hit. And then after Hurricane Katrina, the next one was Hurricane Gustav. So Katrina wiped out New Orleans, and Gustav wiped out Baton Rouge where I lived. And we were inundated with arborist crews. And I would go work for them, like hauling wood from the rooftop to the truck. I mean, that was my whole job. But I watched guys climb. And that was when I realized, whoa, there is so much about tree climbing that I never knew about. Yeah. That's when it just hit me. And that's when I started climbing with arborists.
Yeah.
Because I could tell, I saw this guy doing a move. He was an arborist. He was hanging from a crane, and the boom of the crane was swinging like from the street. There was a tree falling on a house, and the boom is swinging over the house. And as the boom is swinging, he was letting down his rope. So he had this three-dimensional thing where he's coming down like this to the tree. And I saw that, and I immediately fell in love, and I said, I got to learn how to do this stuff. And then I sought out arborists in Baton Rouge, and they started to teach me tree, like real tree climbing.
Yeah, so up until that point, you hadn't even connected the dots with learning the skills of tree climbing with arborists and like somehow gelling those together to get the skills that you need. You thought you had the skills that you needed to do the tasks that you had at the time, and so you hadn't even thought outside of doing that.
I hadn't thought outside my universe. And there's a good side to that, and there's a bad side to that. The good side is that everyone needs to understand that there are different needs in tree climbing. And sometimes, for a lot of what scientists do, all you really need to do is get up your rope, take a look around, and come back. Yeah. You don't need to branch walk. Yeah. You don't need to get out to the branch. You don't need lateral movement, and you don't need a lot of that stuff. So, you know, we need to appreciate that sometimes you can create a solution that is too big. Like, you want to teach someone tree climbing and you want to teach them everything, and they don't need all of that. So that's the good side, is to realize, like, sometimes a scientist only needs to get up and down a rope, and that's what I did, and it worked for me for that time. The bad side is that I was sort of the king of my universe, because I thought I was really good at one thing. I kind of expanded that to mean I must be good at everything in tree climbing. Right? My self-confidence was overinflated. Yeah. And that was a barrier to me realizing maybe I need to learn more. And it wasn't until that one bird flew into that nest and that foliage, and I thought, I need to get over there. And that was when I realized there's got to be more to it than what I'm doing. Yeah. That's when it sunk in.
So it's funny you say that, because as arborists, it's very common, the exact feeling that you had about, you felt like you knew the skills and you had the skills and you'd exceeded to, you know, a really high standard. That happens a lot with arborists as well. If they're the main climber at a tree company and there's nobody else that they can look up to learn new skills from, they feel like they've got all the skill. And it's not until you kind of venture out into the world and like work for other companies that you realize there's way more skills out there that different people are using, like, to learn. I was exactly the same. It's funny, when I started the website climbingarborist.com, I thought I was good at climbing and I thought I knew a lot, and now I realize I knew so little. But having the website helped me, because I then had to go and do a lot of research to find new techniques. And then I started working for different companies, which is what I would always suggest to arborists that are maybe quite new in the industry and they haven't got to a point where they're ready to start their own business. I'd say go and work for different companies and experience just like different crews and different environments, because you're bound to work with people that know different techniques. And
You were giving advice, but you weren't following it yourself, kind of?
No, that wasn't the advice.
That's when you started. You were telling them to work for other companies.
No, that's what I would say now. I would say it's so valuable to go and work with other people, because the more people you work with, the more skills that you're going to collect. Whereas a lot of people, like myself, when I first started, for the first probably 6 years, I was the main climber of the company that I worked for, so I wasn't learning anything new, because nobody else that I worked with even was really interested in climbing, so they couldn't teach me anything.
The two things that I think really help us grow and learn more, one is modesty. And say, maybe I don't know as much as I think I do. And the other one, I guess, is self-awareness. They kind of go side by side. Self-awareness to know, like, what are my limits? And what areas do I need to grow in? And what you're saying is what I believe in. Exposure helps. Exposure helps us adjust our self-perception of where we actually stand in the universe. And when I really started to learn more advanced tree climbing techniques, it's because I looked up arborists in my area. And actually, the very first thing I did was I took a Nats class. And so I took a Nats class in Baton Rouge with Haustain, you know, Michael Haustain?
Yeah, yeah.
That guy's awesome.
Yeah.
And here was this class offered for arborists. It was spar pole rigging and high angle, you know, like spur climbing and stuff. And so here's all these arborists and a PhD student in biology. And so I'm like, I'm spurring up these trees and removing the tops of the trees. And it was so addicting. And And like, I just wanted to be in trees more and more and more. But when I took the class, I met some of the instructors and I met arborists who lived in Baton Rouge. And then they took me under their wing and they started teaching me like how to climb like an arborist. And that changed my whole life. Changed my whole life. And it gave me the awareness to say, okay, there's a lot that I got to start learning. Yeah.
So going back to, so you've learned to climb trees and you're a biologist. What are you actually looking for when you're out in the field? What research are you trying to do?
For my doctorate degree, what I really wanted to understand better that hadn't been studied a lot previously was to get a real good understanding of the ecology of the whole community of birds that lives in the canopy of the rainforest. Because there had only been a couple of studies previously about not just one species, but like all of the species together, that aggregate community of birds that live in the canopy of the rainforest. There had been three previous attempts at doing this. One in Costa Rica, one in Panama, and one in Brazil. And the scope of the studies was kind of limited, and it was limited in the sense that it was the first time it had ever been done. So it was in the real conceptual beginning stage of canopy bird research. And what I wanted to do was take those three studies as a model and then do a longer in-depth study from more vantage points in the canopy and get a more complete understanding of that group of birds that lives on the top of the rainforest. One of the questions I wanted to answer that hadn't really been addressed before was, what are the core canopy species of the rainforest? Which are the birds that are most restricted to and most characteristic of that top layer of the forest? The ones that don't really come down. So like, we know, for example, we can name some birds that live on the ground. Like pheasants live on the ground, turkeys live on the ground, peacocks live on the ground. Okay, we know that. We know that in the middle part of the forest, there's a lot of birds that live in there because we can see them. But that whole layer at the top, we can't see. And so it's not possible to know which are the birds that only live there. So like the ground birds that never go to the treetops, you're not going to see a pheasant in the top of a tree. There are birds that live in the treetops that never come down. But until you get enough observations, and then you can do a statistical analysis and identify those birds, we can't really categorize them that way. And so I wanted to describe them. And then what I did was a comparison where I compared research methods based on the ground, walking, and research methods based in the tree, and quantify the difference. How well can we study canopy birds from the ground? But I had to do both of those, you know, at the same time to come up with data and actual numbers to say that while working from the ground, we're going to miss these species or these behaviors or these interactions. Yeah.
So I presume then, from what you just said, you've spent many a night in a tree, have you? Or
not as many as I would like. I learned tree boating, tree camping, like about 5 years ago from my friend James Luce.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to do it in Idaho, where I live, but it's hard to find big enough trees in Idaho. It's drier and it's colder than like in the Pacific Northwest. And so
it's definitely
drier. And it's hard for me to find, I've started to find some big ponderosas. But I have had some great experiences in Costa Rica and in the Dominican Republic sleeping in the tops of trees. And like, if anyone has ever slept in an old growth Douglas fir or a ponderosa pine, that's a beautiful, amazing, peaceful, tranquil experience. When you do that in the canopy of a tropical rainforest, you know,
not as peaceful?
It's psychedelic. Let's just say it's totally psychedelic.
Yeah.
There are so many insects up there. Like the mosquito, there's this constant drone of mosquitoes. You have to have a mosquito net or you're dead.
Yeah.
And they're all around you. And then the bats are flying back and forth. And because you're suspended and you're sleeping on your back, but you're suspended in the air, the bats are literally going like all angles, including
skimming your tree boat,
right underneath you. And you can just lay there and you hear these fluttering wings like through the lines of your tree boat and underneath your back and like around your head. It's really weird. And then there are these beetles that have these big fluorescent like headlights that glow at night. They're click beetles. But in the United States, click beetles are usually less than an inch long, like half an inch or a quarter of an inch. And these ones are like 2 inches long. And they fly around through the canopy and they make this big buzzing sound, like these little helicopters. And they've got these lights, and it looks like cars commuting through the forest, and they're just swerving around. I mean, it is totally psychedelic.
It's like something out of Star Wars.
Yeah, you've got these lights flying around, and the bats are coming, and you're like, you know, staying away from your mosquito net so the mosquitoes don't bite you through the mosquito netting.
Yeah.
And it's like you don't sleep a lot, but so you come down with a really great story to tell afterwards.
So no drugs are needed when you when you're sleeping in the top of a tropical rainforest.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. So you mentioned, how did you meet James Luce? He's a mutual friend. I know James a little bit, and yeah, such an amazing human being. I was hoping that he could join us today for this podcast, but I'll get to do one another
travel.
Time with him. He's
travel's complicated. What happened was, so I was climbing with these arborists in Louisiana. And one of them said, but I had just gotten a job in Oregon, and I was going to move to near Portland. And one of the arborists that was like teaching me to climb, he said, "You got to meet Ascending the Giants." He said, "These guys are climbing like big trees, and you know, you got to meet them." So I went up to Portland, and they were filming their Treeverse video, and I went to one of the campouts to like help rig trees and stuff, and that's where I met Brian French, and I met Will Coomjin. And I met James, and I met Eric Forsman, who's a famous climbing scientist, really a top scientist and a top tree climber. And I met all of those guys. And then that like sort of blew the top off my tree climbing world, because they were doing such complicated, high-tech, really cool, advanced stuff. And then I started to climb with them, and I started to learn from them, and then I would make visits to climb with those guys. Yeah. And then I asked Will and James one day, like, I wanted to learn how to do lateral movement in trees, and I wanted to learn some other way to climb ropes, and I had heard of the rope wrench. And so I asked those guys, like, "Hey, you got to teach me how to do the rope wrench." And then that happened, and that, like, opened all these other doors and windows, right? Yeah.
So now you do a lot of these things down in South America where you teach people to climb, or you show people techniques and stuff. Is that your main job now, or do you do something and then that's like a bit of a side gig?
I work for a nonprofit bird conservation group called the Peregrine Fund in Boise, Idaho. The Peregrine Fund does raptor conservation all over the world. We study birds of prey in South America and Central America and Africa and Madagascar. We've worked on every continent except Antarctica, and with, you know, over 100 species of raptors. That's where I get my paychecks and my benefits and my insurance and stuff. But something that really keeps my life enriched and gives me the feeling that I'm giving back is that I do international tree climber trainings for biologists in developing countries. And we've done Colombia, we've done Honduras, we've done Costa Rica, and we're going to do Colombia again this year. And kind of the thinking behind this is, you know, when I was younger and wanting to learn how to climb trees, I didn't have a lot of instruction, and I didn't know how to go about it, and I didn't know how to select equipment. I was using the wrong kinds of equipment in many instances. I'm using the wrong techniques, and making mistakes that, you know, quite honestly, a person could die from those kinds of mistakes. And I thought, there's no need for that. A person can learn how to climb trees the right way if they have a teacher. They can learn how to select the right equipment, and we can present these climber trainings that open up a world for them, like my world opened up when I started climbing. And what we do is I partner with arborists, and I partner, and so I have a company called Canopy Watch, and that's the engine that, you know, I use to do all of this work. But I partner with arborists and distributors of tree climbing equipment like Wesper, helps us a lot. I write a lot of grants. And then I work with organizations in Central America, like in last year in 2018, we did a training with the Honduran Ornithological Association. You can look them up online. Their acronym is ASHO Honduras. Yeah. And we did a training to teach biologists from Honduras and El Salvador how to get to the tops of trees safely. Yeah. And it's a beautiful experience, because not only do we teach, you know, basic fundamental skills needed to climb trees, but I really look at it like we change people's lives.
Yeah.
That's the point that I'd really like to share, because these young people never would have imagined that a bunch of strangers would get together, donate all of their time, like I don't make any money from this, donate our time, get equipment donated, buy airplane tickets, and fly down there and teach them something that changes their world, that gets them into the top of the forest, but it also gives them a self-esteem and self-confidence that they never had before.
Yeah.
Because they show up to these trainings and they don't know what tree climbing is. They don't know what they know that there's ropes involved. That's about it. They know that there's helmets involved. That's about it. And when you get them into the tops of trees for the first time, you can see
that's a mind-blowing experience.
It totally blows their minds, and you can literally see the change in their faces. On the first day, they're standing on the ground, and everyone is nervous, and they're self-conscious, and they're holding back, and they're kind of quiet. And then you get them into the trees, and their faces light up, and they've got these big smiles, and like their face expands, and their eyes are wide, and there's this it blows their minds, and there's this amazing gratitude.
Yeah. And it's like, it's probably like their universe just opens up so much wider, because being a biologist or in that field where you're doing research on the rainforest, on animals, that kind of thing, and then never even considering that you would ever get the chance to look from the canopy down.
Yeah.
And then being given the chance to learn how to physically get in there yourself, so you've got the you just feel so good that you actually made that happen by physically climbing the tree yourself.
It's a major accomplishment.
Yeah. So yeah, you have that sense of accomplishment, and then you have the view, and like just being sat in the top of the canopy and seeing birds that you may never have seen before, or you've just read about, or and just you can see how birds kind of navigate the way around the forest more, and their habits and stuff, which you would never really see from below, or even if you do see from below, it looks completely different from above.
It is a totally different world. Being in the top of the rainforest is a totally different world. The view is different, the temperature is different, the plants are different. I, to this day, like I've seen birds in the top of the forest that I've never seen from the ground. I've seen species of ants, and insects, other insects and lizards, you know, that you do not see from the ground. You can't experience that until you get up there. And the wind, you know, and if you get caught in a tropical rainstorm, some of these rainstorms move in really fast, and you're in the top of the tree and you're not tied into like equipment to rappel out of the tree. That storm hits, you just sit there, because they're like these pounding, torrential, tropical rains. And it is an amazing, like, life-changing experience. It really brings you into yourself to live that kind of moment.
Yeah. So do you think then, especially in like the tropical rainforest where you said you can't even see the top of most of the canopies, do you think there are so many undiscovered plant species, bird species, insect species
that
haven't been documented?
It's a fact. Like,
yeah.
It's a fact. And I would really like to have a research program where I could do like biological blitzes, where we could take a group of specialists. So you get a specialist in plants, and you get a specialist in butterflies, and you get a specialist in herps, like amphibians and reptiles and orchids and birds, and just go do a bio blitz in Brazil or go do a bio blitz in Ecuador or Bolivia, we'll discover new species. That's a fact. Orchids, epiphytes, frogs, maybe even birds. Yeah, maybe even new species of mammals. Yeah, we got to get up there.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
To think that.
Yeah. It's the year 2019, I mean, and there's still new species to discover because they live up there where nobody goes.
So do you know anybody else that's doing what you do then? Like, do you know other biologists that are going up there for research purposes in other continents or?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But there are, and so you know, I want to admit that and not take anything away from biologists that work in Australia and Costa Rica or Brazil, but in any one of those countries, it's really normal to have maybe two biologists that study the canopy. And oftentimes they are North Americans. Like, you might have biologists working in the canopy of Indonesia, but they're they're from northern countries, North America or Great Britain, you know, UK. And there are very few of the local people from those countries. That's why we do the international climber trainings, because if you've got two or three scientists who climb into the canopy in Costa Rica, they're from North America and they're not from Costa Rica or Honduras or Panama.
Yeah.
And we want to change that balance because they live there. They walk in those forests every day. That's their world.
They're all familiar and
that's their world, but they've never been, you know, they've never been higher than you can reach with your hands.
Yeah.
And they're there every day. I'm not.
Yeah.
I live in Boise, Idaho. So we need to get them in the tops of the trees and they can do their own research programs when they want, when it suits them, not when it suits me.
So how long are the training programs that you do like down in South America? Does it last like a week, 2 weeks?
It's 5 days, to 5.5 days.
And when you've finished the training, do you then feel comfortable that these guys have enough knowledge and skill from that 5 days of training to let them go off and start accessing canopies on their own? Or do you have some kind of follow-up program if they want to ask questions? Or like, how do you leave it?
That is a really, really good question. You know, anyone who's ever taught a subject, you can look at a high school class or a college class as a starting point. There are always some students who ace that and they walk out of there like masters of that subject, you know? But you've got other people who struggle and then achieve a satisfactory level. And then you've got some who never grasp that subject. The same is true when we teach tree climbing. And if I didn't, I need to admit and just say publicly that if we teach 10 students, right, which has been our normal group size, there's going to be two that come away like you would hire them immediately to work on an arborist crew. They are so good. After 1 week, they are so good. Then you've got a bunch that they like power through and you know that they're competent. Okay? And then there's always some who don't have the same level of confidence or ability that we need to be more cognizant or aware of, right? And we have a really important obligation to safety, not just during the course, but every time I teach one of these courses, my whole mind is consumed with safety because I want to leave behind a legacy of people who can climb and do this well and not get injured. So we kind of have some protocols that we follow. Normally in a climber training that we do, we scrape together somehow a number of tree climbing kits, like complete kits, harness, rope, helmets, beaners, split tails, lanyards, the whole nine yards. And it's always, the number of kits that we give away is always smaller than the number of students. We make sure that the kits are in the right hands.
Yeah.
We make sure that there is supervision afterwards. When we did the training in Honduras, there were two organizers, Carla Carcamo and Carlos Funes, who work for the Honduran Ornithological Association. We left some climbing kits with them. Any graduates of our course who wants to do research have to check out the equipment from Carlos, and they have to have Carlos's supervision. because he was a really good climber. He climbs a lot. He takes climbing really seriously. He's climbing as much as he can. And he supervises them to make sure that they are following the techniques that we taught them. We also make sure that we follow up, you know, digitally. We have conversations on WhatsApp. They'll share photographs or videos of their climbing, or they'll send us a question like, "Is it?" They'll rig up something and they'll say, "Can I do this? Is this safe?" You know, before they go out and climb, and I'll say yes or no. You know, like, or give them some instruction to make sure that. Or they'll just say, you know, "I don't remember if I tied this knot correctly, so I'm going to send you a photograph. Tell me if I tied this distal correctly or whatever." And they'll send me a photo and I'll say, "Right on." Or I'll say, you know, "Take a photo from a different angle." Or I'll say, "Do that again, send me a video." You know, and so safety is always first and foremost. It's always on my mind. And we kind of have protocols that we enforce to make sure that the equipment is used correctly and put in the right hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you said that you've done training in like Honduras, Costa Rica, Colombia. Out of the total amount of students that you've had there doing the training, how many do you know of that have continued to climb and actually do it on a fairly regular basis and maybe incorporate it into their research or their work and that kind of thing?
You know, I can't say with total certainty how many students or do that continue with the tree climbing. Since Honduras was in September of 2018, and right now it's May 2019 today. And I know that in the Honduras training, I think there are 4 or 5 students who have continued training since climbing since then. They have been installing camera traps, for example, to look for species of mammals that they're not sure. Like in a small forest fragment, sometimes a species can get extirpated and no longer lives there. And they're putting up camera traps to document which species of mammals continue to live in some of these cloud forest reserves and forest fragments. And they've put up some live traps, like some, you know, Sherman live traps up in the canopy. And they are writing grant proposals to do bird research. And one of the students from 2018 is also going to be in the 2019 training because he wants to improve his skills, not only as a climber, but he wants to learn more skills to be a better, he wants to be able to teach. And so he wants to do the next training so that he can learn some teaching skills as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've recently you've been lining up this climb that's coming up in Colombia.
Yeah.
When is that?
It's oh my gosh, it's a month from today.
And
1 month from today.
One month from today, and
woo!
So you've been trying to raise money. Through different avenues, and obviously from, if anybody listening to this wants to help to raise money for the project, like to help fund it, they can buy the t-shirt that you launched.
Yes.
So you would go to, what's your website?
I have a website called canopywatch.com.
Yep.
And they can go to a contact page in there and email me.
Yep.
Yep. And they can read more about, actually I have 2 websites, which I need to consolidate. And I would love to have someone with loads of time and goodwill who would like to help me with my websites.
Right.
But I have one website which is purely for environmental education, to teach about methods for tree climbing. Ecology of the rainforest is my number one topic. And just kind of to spread the word about how fun it is to climb trees and why we teach tree climbing. A lot of this self-awareness. And that website is called CanopyWatchInternational.org.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's CanopyWatchInternational.org is my educational website. I write blogs, mostly is what that is blogs. And then CanopyWatch.com is more of a business website where, you know, I can attract people who want to do these sorts of trainings. Yeah. The 2019 training is going to be our biggest ever. We're doubling the number of students, and we're doubling the number of instructors. And we put out, this is really cool, we put out an international call for applications all across Latin America. We got 49 people to apply from eight different countries. And after a really competitive review process, we had a committee that reviewed these like a panel discussion and reviewed all of these applications. We invited 20 students from 7 different countries, from coming all the way north from Mexico and all the way down through Peru. Yeah.
Wow.
And
so what was the process to decide who was going to make the cut? Like, what did you want to see from people? Like, obviously, it's hard to tell if somebody has skills, so you want to see enthusiasm and what their background is and that kind of thing.
Some of the things that we tested for in the application or asked them about in the application were what their research program was. You know, do they actually have a need? Are they ready to climb trees right now? Like, once they leave this course, are they going to go out and do something? Another one was, do they have an affiliation or some sort of support from a university or a research group somewhere that will help pay for some of their expenses? Meaning, you know, not only do they have a research need, but they have some engine to help them accomplish their goals. You know, how well they answered the questions was important. We wanted to see that people were thoughtful, that they had good grammar, you know, like as a sign of a scientist that's going to go on and report their results. We really wanted, it's hard to put into an application process and to make like total transparency, no discrimination is involved, but we want to spread our program around as many countries as possible. So, you know, like we looked at the top candidates, and if we had some who were like really even, could like maybe one of them was from a country that wasn't represented yet, that kind of gave a boost. And we also really wanted to make sure that women were involved, because in Latin America, it's like a lot of countries where women don't always get the same opportunities. And we wanted to make sure that there were women scientists who were represented.
Nice.
Yeah. But there were, I don't remember how many questions were in the application, but we just wanted to see that people were going to come out of this and use the training.
And who do you have, the trainers obviously have to be able to speak Spanish?
Yeah, every so trainer has to speak Spanish.
Who do you have training?
Fantastic. I'm kind of the lead organizer from North America. We've got a partner organization called Fundación Alianza Natural. You can look up Fundación Alianza Natural on the internet and read about them. There are Colombia organizers. And then for instructors, James Luce has been our lead instructor since the very first training in 2016. So he's the lead instructor. James speaks, he's really modest. He speaks much better Spanish than he gives himself credit for. And then we have Patrick Brandt from North Carolina. He has a company called Piedmont Tree Climbing. He's one of these fascinating people who has a PhD in some science field. He works for the University of North Carolina. He also is a certified arborist. Okay, so he's a PhD certified arborist who does arboricultural services. He also does public tree climbs that people pay to go on. He also does training for tree climbing and a lot of cat rescues. And his name is Patrick Brandt from Piedmont Tree Climbing. And then we have Emmett Lawrence from Bellingham, Washington. And Emmett has a company called Solstice Tree Care. He's traveled a lot in Latin America and speaks Spanish as well and is super gung-ho to help us train. And, you know, one really important skill, not only do you have to be like a climber, a good climber, you have to speak Spanish, but you have to have a lot of dedication and a lot of flexibility because there's no payroll, okay? We have no staff. We're on a shoestring all the time. We try and take all the money that we have and invest it right back into the training. And everyone has to play a role. We have to help, like every year we're improving on our curriculum. We have to go out and get sponsorships. We have to go out and get grants. There's lots of questions that go round and around the table. And so it's not like we're not just contracting someone like, hey, I'm going to pay you to go to South America and teach tree climbing. You've got to jump in foot first and say, you know, sign me up. I'm ready to help out. I want to be on this team. The benefits are great. You get a all expense paid trip for a week to a foreign country. All your food and lodging is paid. You get to climb in the rainforest with a bunch of people who are going to love you to death by the end of this course. It's a do-good, feel-good operation. But it's not like, yeah, I'm going to contract you, sign on the line,
yeah,
sort of thing, and there's no pay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's better than pay, though. Like, what you get out of it is, like, so much better than a paycheck.
Yeah, you have to be in it for, you have to be in it for more than just a paycheck. You have to be in it for, I presume you're always bouncing ideas off of each other throughout the year about the next one. And,
yeah.
And you said, like, building the curriculum, so you're always working on something new, and you're always working to gain grants and sponsorship for the next project.
Yeah, like Patrick, for example. Patrick jumped in, he jumped in immediately. At first, I tried to recruit Patrick, and he couldn't join us because he had an obligation at the same time. And I called him one day. I was actually in Panama, and I was so desperate. And I called him, and I said, Patrick, I need some life support here. I need two more trainers, and if you could do this, it'll literally save this program. Not only did he rearrange his prior obligation that was preventing him from going, he stepped in and got us some of the key sponsorships. So he started writing people that he knew, and he got Cheryl Tree to donate 11 Big Shot heads. He asked Kevin Bingham, the inventor of the rope wrench, to donate rope wrenches, and Kevin Bingham, who runs a small company, sent us a box full of rope wrenches. And Patrick, another thing that he's doing is he's helping with the evaluation of the students, because this year we have 20 students and we're going to give away 5 complete climbing kits to the top students. And we need a process of daily evaluation for these students. And he crafted the evaluation, which is really tricky because you don't want to intimidate beginners. You want to inspire a real group atmosphere, and you want to build confidence. And if you're not careful, if you make it look like, okay, now you're going to take an exam, you can scare people, and oftentimes you don't get their best ability because they get nervous and they start to fumble.
Because they're like, oh, I'm being watched now for this little thing. I've got to make sure I do it right.
And then they screw up because they're under so much pressure. And we also we place a premium on building a group, like team building atmosphere. We want everyone working together, and we don't want to have competition like, I'm going to be the best and I'm not going to help someone else because I want to be the only one. And Patrick had to devise a way that we can evaluate our students without making it like it looks like an evaluation. And at the end of the week, we need total confidence that we're going to give away 5 complete climbing kits to the 5 people the right people who are the best climbers and have the most need. And we should thank some sponsors.
Okay? Yeah, no, definitely.
We should thank some sponsors, because we actually are donating 11 complete climbing kits at the end of this event. 5 are going to students and 6 are going to the organizers and partners in Colombia to allow them to continue doing trainings with our supervision and help and research in the canopy. So every one of these climbing kits, I haven't added up the numbers, but it's worth between $2,000 and $2,500. That means they're getting a waterproof haul bag. They're getting a harness. They're getting... All of this stuff is coming from Petzl. Petzl Foundation is donating a waterproof haul bag, a Sequoia harness, a Grillon lanyard, Petzl helmets with visors, ascenders, belay devices, carabiners, you know, foot ascenders, all of that, okay? Yale Cordage is donating 100% of the ropes. Yale Cordage is, I'm calling them our software sponsor. So they are donating a quantity of ropes that is super impressive, okay? Nice. Not only do we have canopy access lines that are tall enough to get people into trees up to like 150 feet tall, but we've got 20 meter or 60 foot canopy lanyards to allow, you know, like long horizontal movements on branches.
Yeah.
They're donating all of that, and they're donating all of the split tails. three per climbing kit. And then Wesper did all of the splicing for all of the ropes and is giving us some support on a lot of the equipment that we didn't get raised through other sponsorships. And let's see, DMM donated all of the pulleys. Tree Stuff, Nick Bonner donated all of the tethers for the rope wrenches. And I think that people, you know, it started with Petzl. Petzl came in with as our hardware sponsor with the equipment. And that was the seed that really planted this training and let people know, like, this is for real.
Yeah.
And once people saw, like, oh, Petzl's in, dang it, I got to get in before it's too late.
Yeah.
I think people realized, like, these people are really doing something good.
Yeah.
And I can help do something good. And it doesn't have to be a great big gift, you know? I mean, a small, like, 11 pulleys is a lot for us. And DMM has that within their grasp, and they made it available, and it's gonna rock the world of a lot of people when they come to this training.
Yeah, that is incredible that all those different companies stepped up to provide something. That's incredible.
And then we have a Canopy Watch. That's me, a lot of time and some money. And like you mentioned earlier, we did a T-shirt campaign. We made close to $3,000. From T-shirt sales, and all of that money is going to pay for the instructor airfare down there.
Yep.
And then Fundación Alianza Natural, all of their organization. We've got a partner that's a university down there. Universidad del Bosque is helping recruit students. They're helping with publicity. And the day before the training, we're going to have a 45-minute presentation. I'm going to give a talk, followed by a panel discussion where all of the instructors sit in front of this big audience and take questions about tree climbing and life in the canopy and ecology of the rainforest and all of that stuff. It's a real big deal. This year we're like blowing the roof off. It's crazy.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And hopefully each year just keeps stepping up and snowballing into something bigger each time.
You know what I really like?
Getting more awareness about it. And
awareness is key. We need to have a publicity campaign. One thing that we really need help with that we're a little bit behind on is building publicity, because we want everyone to know the importance of life in the top of the rainforest for the functioning of the whole ecosystem, and then the need to get up there and train people. And so we really need publicity to get the word out. So thank you very much for helping us share the word on the event. But I would also like to find partners around the world who would like to step up and say, hey man, let's do this in Cameroon. Let's do this in Peru. Let's do this in Indonesia. You know, like, I've got a foundation here that can help organize this. Because,
yeah,
like, I'm working nights, I'm working Saturdays, I'm working Sundays, you know, I'm working my lunch breaks to do all of this. And if we can get a body of people doing these on a regular basis, it'll make it more doable and we'll reach more people in more countries around the world. That's what we need.
Awesome.
God, I hope I didn't just blab too much, but I get,
as soon as I start
to talk about these events, man, I get like excited, you know?
Yeah, and well, no, cool. I mean, you can tell that you're so passionate about what you do because, yeah, your passion is just oozing out, and which is what you want from something like this, like teaching others to be able to get into the canopy, and if you're passionate about it, that's going to come across to them and they're going to get excited for it. And man, it's incredible. So let's wrap it up at that. But thank you very much for joining me, David. That was
Thanks for having me.
Was incredible. And hopefully we'll do it again. And I'll hopefully speak to you after this next trip that you do, and find out how it goes.
Let's make that a gig.
Yeah.
After we do the Columbia training, let's get together and see how it went. Because
there's
going to be a lot of stories to tell when it's like fresh in my mind. It'll be beautiful.
Nice.
All right.
Let's
thank
do
you
it.
Very much, Dan.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.